This is Tidings from Hazel Khan. We're very fortunate today to have Bill McKibben as our guest, an environmentalist, writer, educator, research scholar, and activist. Bill is a significant force in raising our awareness of climate change and in directing international action through his leadership of the 350 movement, which he will tell us about later on in the program. Bill is the author of many books. The first was The End of Nature, originally published in 1989, and most recently, in 2010, the book Earth, spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, with two A's to distinguish it from the Earth we have known. In everything he does, Bill McKibben advocates tirelessly for a kinder relationship between human beings and the planet, whether it's eating local, having smaller families, dismantling our belief that growth is good, and arguing against human engineering and the moral and existential threats of a post-human future. His message today is more urgent than ever. Welcome, citizens of Earth, his website greets us and introduces us to the new Earth. Bill McKibben then goes on to say, "We live on a new planet. We've built a new Earth. It's not as nice as the old one. It's the greatest mistake humans have ever made, one that we will pay for literally forever. What happens next is up to us." McKibben then tells us what we can do as he offers us a guide to living on a fundamentally altered planet. Welcome to my program. Welcome to Tidings. I know you're in great demand to share your expertise and your understanding about what's going on in our traumatized planet right now. And our radio station appreciates very much that you've agreed to speak to our audiences. So thank you.
A great pleasure.
Your many books, including your first book 20 years ago, which was The End of Nature, and your articles and your appearances, have a growing sense of urgency. Listening to them and reading, I just think that even the most stubborn denier these days must surely be feeling some of that same sense of anxiety and urgency as these natural catastrophes sort of multiply in number and in intensity. Are we right to connect the dots between, let's just say, the events of 2010 or the past month or even actually the past week?
Yes, I think absolutely. I think we're getting a pretty good taste of what global warming in its early stages feels like. All the kinds of things that we're seeing now are what one expects as the temperature warms. So you get extreme heat waves. We've had 17 nations so far this year set new all-time temperature records. They account for about 19% of the surface of the land surface of the Earth. Pakistan 6 weeks ago set the new all-time Asia temperature record at 129 degrees. So we see events like this unprecedented heat wave in Moscow. The chief meteorologist said in the 1,000 years for which Russians have been keeping track of history, nothing like this has ever happened. We see that as a sign of the new planet that we're creating. We look at Pakistan, where we see the largest rainstorms ever recorded. That's not surprising, because as we've made the atmosphere warmer, we've also made it more moist. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold, and the atmosphere is about 4 to 5% wetter than it was 40 years ago. That's what makes it possible to have new magnitude of storms.
And in Pakistan, it's not just the floods right now, but it was preceded by the earthquake. Is there a connection there too, or are those sort of unrelated?
I think not. I think tectonic and volcanic forces, for the most part, remain outside of human influence.
Can you talk a little bit more about the science of it? Because it's the numbers, really, that are particularly gripping. You said 4% more wet.
Yes. The most important numbers, actually, are a little more abstract. For the 10,000 years of human civilization that we call the Holocene, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stayed roughly level at 275 parts per million, and that accounts for the climatic stability that marked that period, the period when human civilization arose. When we began to burn coal and gas and oil, we, of course, were releasing millions of years' worth of stored-up carbon down in all those coal mines and oil wells and things into the atmosphere. And that number has gone up from 275 parts per million to its current 390 parts per million. 2 years ago, unfortunately, the first real estimate of how much carbon was too much came from a NASA team headed by our foremost climatologist, James Hansen. They found that any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million was not, as they put it, compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. That's why we've rallied under this 350.org banner around the world with real success in the last couple of years, trying to make the case that we really need to go very, very quickly, that this isn't a problem for our grandchildren, it's a problem for right now.
Yes, I think I'd like you to say a bit more about 350. I think my impression is that it's more well established in other parts of the world than it is in this country.
Well, it's actually been pretty all over the world. Last year on October 24th, we had what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. There were 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries. About 2,000 of those were across the United States, Hazel. It's not an obvious thing to rally around, a kind of wonky scientific data point, but it's unfortunately the most important number in the world, and so we need to be calling people's attention to it. We get another big chance on the 10th of October, 10-10-10, this year when we're holding a global work party. All over the world, people will be putting up solar panels or digging community gardens or whatever it is they do, and using it as an opportunity not only to do good things in their communities, but to send a pointed message to our political leaders: we're getting to work, what about you? This is a very, in some level, amateur effort put together on a shoestring. We've been making it up as we go along, but it has built into a large global movement.
I must confess I didn't join till today, but I did join it, and I've already sent a message to a couple of my friends around here saying we've got to do something on 10-10-10. So the address for that is 350.org for people who are listening in.
Exactly.
And so
right.
what is it that really, you are an activist and as well as a writer and journalist and researcher, I presume. I mean, you've got to do research to get all this information.
Yes.
So as an activist, what is it really, a bit more specifically, that you're asking people to do?
Yes, what we need to do is build a strong movement. And that's what we haven't had in the past. We've relied on the fact that if we explained to politicians what peril the planet was in, they would act, but they haven't done so. Earlier this year, the U.S. Congress didn't even bother to take a vote on the most comprehensive climate legislation yet. Clearly, politicians need to understand that their political careers are in peril, too. And that's why we're going to have to build a movement. It won't be easy. It shouldn't really have to happen. We should just be able to explain the situation and get on with it. But the forces on the other side are very powerful. Fossil fuel is the most profitable industry in the world. So we're doing what we can.
I'm sure you've done a lot of thinking about this. Why is it so difficult to do this work? Why are people so resistant?
Well, there's a great deal of inertia because we're very used to the world that we live where we use lots of fossil fuel. So it's hard to get us to think about it very much, and there's enormous vested interest on the other side. You know, Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. In our political system, that equates to influence, and if all you need to do with that influence is delay and stall, then you're really sitting pretty.
Well, I guess we changed a few things. I changed cigarettes and drunk driving and things like that.
We've changed more important things than that. You know, we've seen the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. This is on the same scale. In fact, because it's planetary and because it's for all time, it probably matters even more.
The problem is that people just cannot really identify their self-interest in the whole thing.
It may be that they have no self-interest in a certain way. You know, unless they care about the future or about other people. Or about the rest of creation. For some Americans, especially older ones, the smartest thing, if one was thinking only about oneself, might be to just keep living just the way you're living and hope you can get away with it for another 5 or 10 years. For pretty much everybody else in the world and all the people yet to come, that's a unforgivably selfish way to keep on going.
The other number that is very striking is that we've had 1 degree of temperature rise of actual warming, right? In however long the period
is. Globally averaged.
Right. But the prediction is for 4 to 5 degrees.
That's right. So that sort of tells you the danger. If 1 degree is melting the Arctic as it is, we really do not want to find out about, what 5 degrees is going to look like.
Can you talk a little bit more about the whole concept of growth and expansion as the basis of so much, certainly of capitalism, but of our condition? You know, we think growth is good. And
we've come through a period when growth has been sort of our mantra. We've spent the last 200 years growing very quickly, mostly because we've liberated the immense power of fossil fuel to allow us to, you know, in essence, have many servants apiece. That period, I think, is coming to an end, or we should try to bring it to a good and comfortable end. We're running out of some of that fossil fuel. We can tell because look what we have to do to go find oil. Look what BP was doing in the Gulf. We can't no longer afford to burn it because of the damage it does to the environment. So in the world that comes next, you know, we're not going to just, you know, shut down the internal combustion engine, toss in a wind turbine and carry on exactly as before. I think the world we're building will look different, and it'll be less oriented towards growth and more interested in security, durability, stability, permanence, other virtues.
Predictability, too.
That would be nice, too. Absolutely.
Talk about fossil fuels as the devil, I mean, as the cause of a lot of this. But whether it's the cause or effect, and sometimes I think it doesn't even matter, there's systemic change, not just in the climate, but in so many other institutions. I just wonder if you think that they are in some way connected, if you do think of the planet as a unitary entity, as, say, Gaia, the Gaia hypothesis or something like that.
I think there's no question that, we're learning that it's not only our banks that are too big to fail, but many of the other arrangements of modern life, food and energy probably chief among them. These are very top-heavy, brittle, vulnerable systems. We saw last week that the severe drought in Russia was enough to cause the Kremlin to cease the exportation of grain, which in turn is driving food prices higher already all around the world. These are tightly coupled systems, and as vibrations begin in one, they spread to others with ruinous results. It's one of the reasons we'd be very smart to try to build down while we can and reduce some of that vulnerability.
Can you give an example of what you mean by building down?
Local food systems are a perfect example. To the degree that your community is able to supply some of its needs close to home, that's very good. It makes it much more stable and helpful. Local energy systems, to the degree that we're able to replace big centralized generating stations with solar panels and community wind turbines and intense energy efficiency in our homes. That makes things more secure and stable instead of more leveraged. We have a lot of leverage in our systems.
Kibben, noted environmentalist, author, teacher, and activist, is describing how Earth has changed and telling us how we can change so we can live on this altered planet. Mm-hmm.
you also talk about people living, how little time we actually have face-to-face time with people. I think you somewhere I read or heard about shopping in a supermarket.
You know, when you go to the farmer's market, it turns out you're 10 times as likely to have a conversation as if you're shopping at the supermarket. So that's good. It demonstrates that there are benefits beyond the merely pragmatic desire to prevent deep environmental trouble that should cause us to be thinking more cleverly about the world.
Yeah, because I think you said somewhere, somebody said, we don't really need our neighbors anymore.
That's right. I think fossil fuel has made us among the first of our kind to have no practical need of our neighbors. That's a good way of putting it. But we desperately need to get back to that sense of community and connection for psychological reasons, but also for very pragmatic and utilitarian ones. That's how we're going to deal with the much more chaotic world that we're creating.
What you were saying about the Russians not being able to export their wheat is also going to happen in Pakistan, because a lot of those floods were in the Punjab, which is where they grow wheat.
An important grain belt.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So they're now going to have to import. So this is another way of looking at it. If the planet were a person, were a human being, what symptoms? I mean, if the planet were a human being, would it be going to a doctor for making an appointment, saying it's about time to go and see a doctor, or would it actually be in intensive care in the hospital?
I think it might well be in the emergency room, wondering what the devil is going on. High fever and heavy sweating; those are the main symptoms at the moment, and they're completely unprecedented. I'm afraid the doctor would have very little idea, because, just as with humans, there's a expected range of high temperature and things. We're way beyond it already on the planet. It's as if you showed up at the emergency room with a temperature of 126, the doctor would have no idea what to do. In this case, we're lucky. We know already what the prescription is for bringing this fever down. We have got to get off coal and gas and oil, and we've got to do it fast. That's a very hard pill to swallow. But we really have no choice.
I was wondering if the planet looked at itself in the mirror as a human might, would it recognize itself?
I mean, I think not. Yeah.
I mean, I think you mentioned the Apollo, those wonderful Apollo photographs.
Those Apollo photographs, they're as out of date as my high school yearbook photo, There's about 40% less ice in the Arctic than there was when those were taken, and so the planet looks very, very different even to the naked eye. This is a new Earth that we're building. That's why I, used that odd title for the book, EARTH. The planet looks like the old one. It has the same number of continents, and the gravity still works and all of that. But in very fundamental ways, most of its physical systems are now shifting pretty decisively.
So it's an altered, the way one might alter a book or something, if one was an artist, it's an altered Earth. And
yes,
that's why you call it EAARTH.
Yes, exactly right.
So that also means we have to have an altered way of living on it.
We are going to have to figure out some new habits, and I think that dealing with those growth questions that you talked about before is one of the most important.
The other, again, this is more of a conceptual thing. People are pretty much used to the concept of tipping point. Books have been written about it, Malcolm Gladwell and so on, and people understand tipping point, that things change when you go, it's like boiling point.
Mm-hmm.
But you you've put in a slightly different way. I think they're allied, but they may not be the same. The idea of that we have come up against the limitations of physics and chemistry.
Yeah, we've clearly passed all kinds of tipping points already. What we're experiencing is just the reality of the laws of nature. Past 350 parts per million, there's too much energy in the system. Things begin to go increasingly awry. And, would that it were different. But able as our politicians are, they are unable to amend the laws of physics and chemistry, and that's the opponent here. It's not ideology. It's not Republicans versus Democrats. It's human beings versus the laws of nature.
It's a pretty formidable opponent, a pretty formidable struggle.
If we don't make it a struggle, if we are willing to work cooperatively, then the laws of nature are an enormous assist. It's only when we insist on disobeying them, usually for short-term gain, that we run into serious trouble.
But the other thing about this limit is that it's irreversible, isn't it? I mean, there's something inevitable and inexorable about it.
Well, look, we're not going to stop global warming, but we have plenty that we can still do. So far, the temperature's gone up 1 degree, and there's probably another degree in the pipeline from carbon we've already emitted. But as you pointed out earlier, we may be facing 4, 5, 6 degrees before the century is out unless we act swiftly. There's a world of difference, maybe a habitable world of difference, between a 2-degree increase and a 5-degree increase.
This is your life, right? You're consumed with this, and this is what you do every day of your life. In some way, you're engaged with this issue. So how do you keep, you must sometimes feel despair or at least gloom.
Well,
or lament, you know, it's not, you're not just
sometimes
lamenting, you must have some.
Sometimes. You know, I've had longer to deal with this than most people. I wrote the first book about all this 21 years ago, so I've had some time to work out some of my angst about it all. And now I find it quite good to be able to wake up every morning doing something about it. We worked as hard as we can at 350.org. It's all volunteer labor. But that there are people all over the world engaged gives me great heart.
And action has followed. I mean, one of the things about any kind of activism, I think, is one does it from one's heart, but then you do need to somehow see something, some reward.
Yes, it would be an overstatement to say that we've had great success. So far, fossil fuel is way ahead, winning easily. The only answer to that is to build a bigger and stronger movement. It's possible to make real change. At Copenhagen last year, we convinced 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target, but they were the wrong 117, the poorest and most immediately vulnerable, not the richest and most addicted. So we've got our work still to do.
What is it that you want people to do? What do you want them to say to their elected officials, in this country anyway?
Well, in this country, on the 10th of October, we'd like them to do something in their community that points in the right direction, and then at the end of the day, put down the shovel and pick up the cell phone and call their congressman's office and say, I'm getting to work, what about you? And to say it with a little bit of heat and passion, since these guys have punted and in a serious way. We need them to then be willing to keep this movement going for many months and probably many years ahead as we fight for each inch of ground. It's going to be very, very difficult, and it's possible that we will not win. In fact, it might even be probable that we won't win because the opposition is very powerful. But, you know, that's not really a bet you're allowed to make. The clear moral duty is to do what one can to change the odds of that wager a little.
That's because that's the thing, you know, I asked you before, why are people resistant? Why are the politicians resistant? And I've never understood, same with so many other issues like chemicals in everyday life and so on. I don't understand how these politicians are able to keep themselves somehow as exceptions, that they don't think that this applies to them or their children or their backyards. Is that the secret, that we've got to really make them realize that this applies to them as well? And I don't know how you do that, but...
Look, the only way to do it, I mean, there's no... I'm afraid that the appeal to reason and sentiment and whatever is unlikely to succeed. The question is, can we appeal to their sense of power? Can we make them feel in any way that we can either punish them or reward them for their actions? And to the degree that we can, then we'll make some progress.
Yeah, I was just thinking the president, or I think it's the president of the Maldives, or the Maldive Islands.
Ah, yes.
You don't have to convince him. He's seen it.
No,
his island is underwater or about to be.
Mohammed Nasheed.
And his people.
A great man.
Yeah. and his people are going to have to move or something, right?
They may well. They're putting money aside out of their federal budget to try to buy a new homeland someday, though no one knows quite where it will be. But in the meantime, he is absolute leader in the fight for doing something to slow this down. He and Todd, his whole cabinet had a scuba dive so they could hold an underwater cabinet meeting during this big event last October and pass a 350 resolution kind of against the backdrop of their dying coral reef. A great man.
How, and does he talk to Mr. Obama?
I doubt that he's considered important enough to talk to Mr. Obama very often, but I know he saw him at Copenhagen, which was good.
Well, I hate to end on a sort of despondent note, but I mean, all one can do is do one's best, I guess, and we'll certainly organize
all
something.
One can do is try to do one's best at the same time and with the same message as a lot of other people. And that kind of unity is very important. It gives us some chance of breaking through.
So are the people who are working on 350.org, are they in Middlebury where you are, or are they all over
Scattered around the world. The main, if to the degree that we have any headquarters, it's in San Francisco, but people in Barcelona and Mexico City and Johannesburg and, you know, Beijing and hither and yon, I guess would be the correct description.
Yeah, there's wonderful photographs on the website of people.
And these are people who deserve everybody's great thanks. They're mostly young people. They're all working basically for free. We're doing this large-scale thing without any real resources, unfortunately, but such as it is, you know, and on we go.
But people should just go and look at your website just to see the different ways in which 350 is expressed.
Yes, it's very exciting. It's very creative, and it makes the point that most environmentalists around the world aren't rich and white and affluent. They're mostly poor and black and brown and Asian and young.
You've been listening to Bill McKibben describing how Earth is no longer the place it once was and what we can do to live on our altered planet. You can learn much more about Bill McKibben's work at 350.org and at billmckibben.com. That's BILLMCKIBBEN.com. This is WPKN 89.5 Bridgeport and streaming at WPKN.org, where Tidings can be heard at 6:30 p.m. on the second Wednesday of each month. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.